Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to ModPath Chat, the official podcast of Modern Pathology, featuring interviews with authors and experts on the latest science, technology, and developments in the field of pathology. Your host, Dr. George Netto, is the editor-in-chief of Modern Pathology and the chair of pathology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Here's Dr. Netto.
Welcome to a special episode of ModPath Chat. We're fortunate today to be joined by Dr. Victor Reuter from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Dr. Reuter is the vice chair of pathology at Memorial and a professor of pathology and lab medicine at Weill Medical College of Cornell University. As a leading international expert in the field of geopathology, his achievement has been recognized by numerous prestigious awards, including the ASCAP Cash Mustofi Distinguished Service Award and the ISUP Cost Medal for eminent service in the advancement of urologic pathology. Dr. Reuter has served the Academy in several roles, including a tenure as an ASCAP president. In 1991, he established one of the earliest fellowship in geopathology at Memorial and had since mentored many, many who are now expert. I'm proud to be one of his earliest mentees, and I've learned a lot through the years from Dr. Reuter. Always a visionary, Dr. Reuter was one of the earliest anatomic pathologists to embrace and advance the genomic and more recently the digital transformation of our field. Thank you, Dr. Reuter, for accepting my invitation.
Thank you, George. It's a pleasure to speak to you tonight.
In the next few minutes, as you know, 15 to 20 minutes, I'm looking forward to hear your vision and your perspective on digital pathology. I know we can do several episodes on that and on the other great contributions you've had to the field, but let's focus today on digital paths. And let's start with some historical notes. So when did you get interested in this and why and what happened? How did it start?
As usual, as everything in my career is all a coincidence, you know, it's one of those things. You bump against one wall and then you bounce to another wall, et cetera. So in 1998, I became acting chief of surgical pathology at Memorial. And I was pretty much in charge of technology innovation. So in those days, well, as you know, surgical pathology is a very manual discipline. We do the cutting the tissue, putting the blocks, processing, embedding it, cutting it, staining it, deparaffinizing it, et cetera. So my idea was to automate the laboratory as much as possible. Well, you know, digital pathology is nothing but automation. So it's somewhere around 2006. We started seeing some excitement in this area, started with the company Bacchus and Olympus and some other companies, including Demetrics. A pathologist who was a GU pathologist, Dr. Ron Weinstein from the University of Arizona, was a pioneer in the area of digital pathology, started a company called Demetrics. So I visited everybody because the whole idea was, how do we better quantify a signal? And you would think that you would have to do it in an objective mathematical way. So obviously, if you digitize the image, and then you can measure and maybe turn immunohistochemistry from something that is subjective to objective quantitative. So that was really the genesis of all of this. Wow. We visited all of the all of the companies. We decided to go with one, and we started using it. And then trying to see how it fit into the laboratory. The problem was that in those days, we were not barcoding the slides. So from a point of view of following it and really being able to annotate the data, it was very difficult. So within 2012, we were not an early starter there. We started barcoding, and now we started understanding how we could put together an entire case using barcodes and in the information from every block. So move on forward, and we have new technologies, better technologies, faster scanning, et cetera. And suddenly we find ourselves in 2016, 2015, with a chairman that embraced the concept of digital pathology, and that was David Klemstra. And together with Mira Hamid, the chief of surgical pathology, we convinced the institution of what the return on investment was. Mm-hmm. And the return on investment is not always financial. It's also enabling. So for example, in an institution that has multiple hospitals, to be able to consult with each other, to be able to sign out cases or look at cases remotely from one site to the other, to be able to share offices and look at cases, et cetera, to do quality assurance. So we spun it in a way in which we really focused on quality of care and extended ability of the mothership laboratory to other institutions, to other spokes in the wheel. And that's how we were able to grow the system. But of course, we learned along the way. Early adopters always pay a price. Mm-hmm. The price is by making mistakes, and the price is maybe spending a little bit more time and effort and a little bit more money in to be able to streamline the operation. And what we've learned is that really for this to be successful, you have to create an ecosystem. It's not a question of buying hardware. The question is, for example, displays of high resolution enough that you're going to be able to look at images with high fidelity, that you're going to be able to have displays that are large enough that you see enough of the image at enough of a magnification, that you're going to be able to have a system in which you can visualize the images within your laboratory information system, that you're going to be able to use viewers that accept not only one file format size or type, not size, type. Because what if you want to buy a hardware from another company several years down the road? You want to be able to look and use them and be able to pull them up in the same browser. So you need a file type agnostic or what's called a universal browser to do this. How do you put the cases together as a case? How do you let the pathologist or the fellow or the resident know the case is ready for you to be viewed? So there's so many pieces that had to come together, and that's why you have to create an ecosystem for this really to work. And we have, and it's not perfect. It's still nascent. We are scanning approximately consistently over 30,000 slides a week, over 125,000 slides a month. Our digital repository now is well over 4.5 million slides. We are scanning forward as well as backward to the first day that we started barcoding, which is about 2012. So ultimately, we are going to have all of that material. And you know how prized that is, because this material, now you have annotated clinical data. Mm-hmm. So you're going to be able to digitize the slides. You don't have to pull the slides from the form, from the file, from your repository to know which one you want to send. For example, get a block to send for genomic analysis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So once you digitize the slides, for example, our biopsies, let's assume that the patient had a biopsy 6 months ago and you want to see it, and you say, tell the resident, pull these slides from me. Well, you don't have to do that. So our number of recalls or requests to our archive to pull slides from our archive now is down by 94%. Think of the return on investment regarding FTEs. Now you can repurpose these people to do other functions within the laboratory.
And also the time saving.
It's time saving and financial saving. Now, for example, in New York, storage, every square foot costs you a lot of money. So now you can store remotely, right? Because you're not going to be requesting the slides back because the chances are that you're going to already have these digitize them. So you see that the return on investment is quality of care, it's efficiencies, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a no-brainer, George. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And it is our responsibility to convince our institutions of what the return on investment is, the efficiencies, and also the quality of care and safety over time.
Wonderful. You already have touched on the next portion of discussion, which is where we are now, and you can use your institution as an example, and you've mentioned some of these. But how do you see the field of digital path right now? What's really being used, even in terms of solutions, FDA approved or not, in terms of integration? In the departments that were leading the wave, including yours?
So there are roadblocks. And one of the great roadblocks, of course, is creating that ecosystem that I talked about. That's financially, that's a lot of money. And it takes also a lot of people resources and administrative resources to be able to get all of these things together. So that, I think, is the greatest barrier. The second barrier is also the fact that pathologists in general are very conservative human beings, and they love their microscope. I love my microscope, too, but I see the future. So you can have the microscope. For example, one of the things that it can enable, let's say, for example, that I have all the biopsies that have been scanned. In GU, we scan all biopsies, as we do in every other field in our department. They're scanned every morning. They come out, they're scanned by 10 o'clock in the morning. 95% of all slides are scanned. So in theory, I can review those biopsies from wherever. Let's say a pathologist feels a little bit uncertain. The slides are still available. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in my experience, about in 1 in 10 of sets of prostate needle biopsies, not 1 in 10 pieces of tissue, but cases, mm-hmm. I might want to review one of the parts. So those slides are available. So I can look at the entire case, write all the synoptic report, and then when I go to the hospital tomorrow, I'll just review that one slide or two slides, make up my mind, and sign out the case. And for the ones that I have no problem with, I can sign them out from my home. So where we are now is in the process of enabling this technology for pathologists to use it to their benefit. We're not going to force anybody to do this. We are going to create all the tools necessary for them then to use it, how it fits into their practice. There will be chairs out there that will say, next July 17th, we're going to convert entirely to digital. They will not be very popular with pathologists, but there will be some that will do that. But right now, where we are is we're scanning a lot of material. We're trying to do it in a time-sensitive fashion. We are trying to make sure that the pathologist, that we create an infrastructure of scanning more and more cases complete so that they have the ability from their office or from their home or from another satellite of the institution to review those cases. So that's where we are now. And different institutions are at different levels. And what I've noticed is that some institutions that are leaders that have a lot of experience, I think Anil Parwani is a good example at Ohio State University. I think he's a very good example of a leader, a pioneer who's doing a lot of this stuff. And other institutions are now putting their toes in the water, and they're going to the meetings, they're listening to the lectures to see how this might fit into their workplace. So I think that's where we are now. So it's all about the digital images and the cases that are being archived and creating that ecosystem that I was talking about.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So interested in knowing, you mentioned like 1 out of 10 sets of biopsies you feel maybe there is a slide you want to review. Usually what's the reason for that? Is degree of comfort, or clearly you should be very comfortable with reading off screen, but yeah. Is it the scanning wasn't good in that area, or
there are scanning problems, and we're not going to go into detail of QA post and pre imaging and things like that. But as you know, in our slides, we have folds as well. So correct. Sometimes we have problems or poorly fragmented tissue. But let me give you a couple of examples in prostate cancer. You have an introductal lesion and you're wondering if this is florid high-grade PIA and a typical cribriform hyperplasia or introductal carcinoma. That might be one. Let me give you another one. You have an atypical small acid proliferation associated with inflammation. You might want to take a better look at an area like that. So those are just two examples of, atypical glands in an area of a fold. You know,
gives you a better feel still.
We're learning as what, you know, it's like correct. Everybody else. In those areas, I might want to ask for a recut. I might want to make a definitive decision. I might make the ultimate decision. Yes, I want to order stains. But if I'm doing it remotely, I can already be ordering the stains. So when I come to the office next day, the stains will be ready. So again, it's going to be more efficient.
Excellent. And this may be, it bridges the timelines of current versus futures, those solutions that now are coming up for, be it immunohistochemical or biomarker for breast biopsy or for prostate biopsy, assisting the pathologist, or even for integration of workflow. Like the last episode was with a group from Oxford talking about integrating where the scan slides, the AI program will order the pin 4 on the atypical foci for you. By the time the slides make it to you, the immunohistochemistry has been ordered. It's not perfect yet, but do you see these more and more becoming the norm, or is it a hype? Should we invest in those solutions? As you know, they're not cheap.
Yes. Well, first of all, we have to create the infrastructure, as we talked. And then, you know, that is the now. So now, I mean, right now to the next year or two. But where the science is going is really in annotations, in machine learning, in artificial intelligence. So the low-hanging fruit is identifying the cancer, minimal metastatic disease. You know how much time consumption there is in looking all the lymph nodes
levels
at relatively high power, looking for those four or five glands. If you develop an algorithm that can do for that, it might be tumor type agnostic, because metastatic breast cancer looks good at, close enough to metastatic gastric cancer, close enough to metastatic colonic cancer, that, you know, you could have maybe a tumor type agnostic type algorithm. Yes, I think that's a possibility. The other ones that companies like Ibis and Google and Page AI that are developing of identifying the cancer, minimal cancer, identifying the cancer and measuring the cancer, telling you the percentage of the core that is involved. As you know, many of the cores are actually not linear, so you have to sort of move around. Developing algorithms that measure for you is not that difficult. And then telling you what percentage of the tumor is, grading the tumor, for example, telling you how much is grade 4 and 5 once the algorithms, you trust that they're grading correctly. All of these things are possible. CIS versus reactive changes in the urothelium. And when you say about ordering immunos ahead of time, that is in the future, and it might be there, but we're going to have to be very involved in doing that, because if we trust it too much, because you want something to be sensitive and not specific, right? So you want it to err on the side of over-calling.
But so that's over-ordering.
Correct. So that's order. So as a chairman, you know,
correct,
that that's not good.
And we discussed that exactly in the previous.
So we have a very important part in selecting which are going to be the next tools that people should work on and that we should trust. And I would push that one a little bit more into the future. But yes, it's coming. But a lot of other things. For example, why should we be quantifying HER2? Why? Why should we be quantifying MIB? Why should we be quantifying ER and PR?
The what machine should do it.
What are the chances of you and I agreeing within one standard deviation if we do 20 cases in a row? There's probably a good chance that we might not. So by developing algorithms that we can trust and validate, we are leveling the playing field. And ultimately, if we do that, and we correlate it not to me, oh, the algorithm agreed with Victor, so what? What we have to correlate is with genomics and outcome and response to therapy. So now you're pushing it farther along. So that is where we are, to make sure that the ultimate goal is the patient, so that we do all these things in a clinically validated and well-designed study manner, so that we really develop tools. And once we do that, the pathologist becomes a monster, because now he has all these tools available to him that make him more efficient, that level the playing field with the pathologist in the community setting, small academic center that has only one specialist in each division, and multiple specialists that can show cases to each other within one discipline, leveling the playing field. And what does that do? It helps the patient quality of care. So we keep the focus on that. And again, all of these things might think like Star Wars, George, it's a matter of if. It's not a matter of when. If you look at the things and you follow the science of what these information scientists, the computational pathologists and people, what they're working on, Amazing. We as pathologists are not hearing about that because we don't ask them to come because it looks like science. It looks like too much Star Wars, but it's not. And they're working on things that ultimately are going to help us tremendously.
Absolutely. But as long as we're working together, I think that's...
We have to work together. But think about this, George. And this is why you as a chairman that are young enough to be able to influence the American Board of Pathology have a role. What is our role in designing what a pathologist is going to be educated for and tested with in the next 5 to 10 years? What is their curriculum in a residency program going to look like or in a medical school to be able to adapt to these things? So this is common knowledge to them. Just like molecular pathology now is becoming, they're pretty good. You know, they're pretty good at it. Well, you know, they learn it a lot in residency programs, but we have to move it so that we have to shift it to the left and for them to be understanding this. How much bioinformatics do they have to learn as a resident? And we are going to clear part of their mind and part of their time to develop as a modern pathologist. We're good at cells, whether they're circulating as single cells or whether they're part of a piece of tissue or if they're floating within urine or an acidic fluid. We're good at that. So we should be leading that effort to be able to, you know, in a AI, machine learning, neural network manner, to be able to say, this is the question that I want to know. Is ARV7, and for those who don't know what that means, is an AR variant that is resistant, usually seen in castrate-resistant prostate cancer. Can we predict that from an image?
From an image.
For example, there's so much information in that cell
beyond
our eyes. Let's take advantage, and we are the ones that are going to benefit from it as well as the patient.
That is such a positive and encouraging note. Thank you. So I think we're almost running out of time, but this episode deserves to be longer than usual. If you have to make a prediction in 10 years, how these modern pathologists and future pathologists, if we do our job right and maintain the turf by adopting and embracing and helping develop and training, how do you see the role of the pathologist or how the pathologist will be practicing in 10 years? So all on screens, all on computers?
We'll be, I think 10 years from now, we'll be all on screens. There'll be a microscope or two available because we have to do QA on the slides and things like that. But we'll be doing basically the overwhelming majority of our work will be on screens. We will all have available to us machine learning tools, algorithms to help us for whatever our tasks are, depending on the specialty. A typical endometrial hyperplasia versus carcinoma. Which cases should be profiled for whatever it is, gene of importance in that particular stage and disease. So this is where I think we will be. And at the same time, I think that we will have a much bigger part in identifying and using the molecular underpinnings of tumors and cells and the microenvironment to include in our reports in an integrated report that is going to look very, very different from the one that we have. And I think that's going to be our role. I think we're going to be different. Our skill sets are going to be different. Our tools are going to be different. And if we do this right, we can be at the head of the table moving the field forward, and pathology will have a long and distinguished career, but very different than the pathologist of the 1800s, 1900s, 1950s, the year 2000. But we'll still be at the front of the table, I hope.
That's wonderful. On such a positive note again, and expectation that I'm sure you're going to be right, knowing you've been right throughout my career. A lot of things that you taught several of us and were a leader in adopting turn out to be true. So I'm pretty sure on this too. So thank you very much. It's been wonderful. And personally for me, it's a special treat and pleasure to have you. And I'm sure the audience enjoyed it. And we have to get you back to talk more about this stuff on our chat if you liked it.
George, it's a pleasure. And on a personal note, please give Ruby a hug from me, okay?
Thank you very much. Wonderful.
Right. Have a good night.
Good night.
Any opinions expressed in this podcast are the speaker's own and do not represent the views of Modern Pathology, Springer Nature, UAB, or USCAP. Your ModPath Chat host and scientific director is Dr. George Netto. Producers are Christina Crow, Amber Jackson, Dr. Sarah Jang, and Dr. Catherine Ketchum. Technical direction is provided by Kaminsky Productions, music by Mitch Neubauer. Thanks to the authors, reviewers, and editors of Modern Pathology for making this podcast possible.